Good morning and welcome to the September 9th, 2015 edition of Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting to you live from the University of California campus in Irvine. We're streaming on the web at kuci.org. We are always available via podcast. I'm your co-host, Marie Stone. We're doing what we do every single Wednesday morning, which is talk with authors, not only about their books, but about their writing process, creativity, craft, all the things that separate those of us who want to write fiction from those of us who publish fiction. Whether it's fiction or nonfiction, literary or mystery, we do it all. And actually, we're going to do a little bit of all of that today. It is my pleasure to welcome Carol Higgins Clark. And in the second half, we're bringing back Daniel James Brown for another chat about Boys in the Boat. He talked with Nicole about that last year, but it's been newly adapted for young readers. So we're going to chat about its adaptation and more generally writing nonfiction and choosing compelling topics and all of that stuff. Stay with us for that. But first, Carol. Carol Higgins Clark is, of course, the author of the best-selling Reagan Riley Mysteries. She is co-author, along with her mother, Mary Higgins Clark, of a best-selling holiday mystery series. She's also an actress. She studied at the Beverly Hills Playhouse and has recorded several novels. She received Audiophile's Earphones Award of Excellence for her reading of Jinxed. She lives in New York City. And more importantly, if you're listening here in Orange County or anywhere near Southern California, Carol is going to be the keynote speaker at the Ladies of Intrigue presented by the Sisters in Crime in Orange County. They're featuring a number of remarkable women mystery writers. Barbara DeMarco Barrett is going to be a moderator on one of the panels. It is Saturday, October 3rd at the Hotel Huntington Beach near Bella Terra. If you haven't gotten your tickets yet, you should pre-register. Members are like $60 now, and non-members are $70. It's a full day of amazing mystery writers. Carol is a keynote speaker there, and you do not want to miss out. You can go on their website, ocsistersincrime.org, and check that out. So we're going to get a little preview before that of Carol. Carol, welcome.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thanks for coming on. What a fun interview this will be. What fun books you write.
I hope so. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. So I want to take, for those of us who, or for those listeners who don't know Reagan very well, you have a highly loyal audience of readers, and, you know, they can't get enough of Reagan. So I wanted you to talk a little bit about Reagan and why she is so beloved by so many readers, and kind of what we can learn about her character as writers that appeal to the masses and that keep your readers coming back for her.
Well, when I started writing, someone had actually suggested it to me. I did some of my mother's books on tape, and I was pursuing an acting career. And he said, you know, he got to know me, and he goes, you know, I think you could write. And he said, you should write a part you could possibly play. So for a series, so I came up with Reagan Riley. I made her a private investigator. And the publisher who I spoke with said, make her mother a mystery writer. And I said, okay, because my mother is a suspense writer, of course, and I just got to work. So I have Reagan just in a lot of different situations. I have her in different places, different locations. And after the first Christmas book my mother and I wrote together, we used Reagan and one of my mother's continuing characters, a cleaning woman who won $40 million in the lottery and is now an amateur sleuth. We put them together to solve a crime where Reagan's father is kidnapped, and Reagan met Jack at that time, and he's the head of the major case squad in New York. So they're married now. And basically, when I just sit down to write a new book, I try to think of a good plot, an interesting story, and just have fun with Reagan.
Yeah, yeah. So tell us a little bit about her, because, you know, in the rule for romance novels is to draw female characters very broadly so you can interject yourself kind of into the book, so readers can have the experience of being in the book. That's not true of Reagan, but she's really connecting with your audience in a way that I think is really lovely. So tell us a little bit about her character and why you think she's such an appealing person to people.
Well, I think first of all, she's a nice person, but I think she's funny.
Yeah,
you know, she. I think that. That sometimes she has reactions to things that people might or that might make people laugh. And she's smart. She's helping people with this crime solving. a lot of times it just, she just happens upon something and then it ends up solving a crime. But I think basically I tried to make her someone who you would want to be your friend or someone you'd want to hang out with, you know, a likable person, but smart and funny.
Right.
And interesting to be with.
Right, right. So tell me about sustaining her over time, because you've got to have her, you know, she met Jack, she got married, they are now starting their life together, and he, but you have to, because you've been writing them, I think your first book came out in, what, 2003?
No, my first book came out in 1992.
Oh, my gosh. Okay. So
23 years ago.
23 years ago.
And Reagan has stayed the same age, you know, so I'm not playing her anything.
But the world around her has changed a lot. So maybe,
Exactly. Yeah, well, when I first started writing, they had just invented the fax machine, or it had just started. So I had Reagan on a cruise ship, and she had come from Oxford, England, and was helping the police solve a crime. I would never have been able to write that with her on a cruise ship if there hadn't been faxes. Well, since then, of course, we have the internet, cell phones, everything. It changes all the time, as you know. So now, of course, Reagan has a cell phone, but just keeping up with technology so she sounds like, you know, she's current, you have to do that. And just the whole way of writing a mystery has changed because we have so much more technology of tracking people, or there's DNA. I mean, there's just a lot more where you can't just have someone go missing. People do go missing, but you know what I mean. It's not people are, their pictures are taken all the time with security cameras. I mean, it's just a different world. And so you have to adapt to that as a writer when you're writing a mystery.
And how much research do you have to do to keep up with DNA evidence and all that kind of stuff?
Well, I don't really use DNA much, but I'm always, thankfully for the computer, there's so much you can look up.
Yeah.
And even not just technology, but you're writing on a topic and say, let me take a look at that. And the problem is you can end up clicking on more and more articles that are interesting when you should be writing, but it's very helpful having that at your fingertips, just being able to look up so many things. But whenever I set a book in a different location, I always travel to the location. I would never just rely on what I read about a place. I'd always go there first. But again, with the computer, there's so much you can just look up.
Yeah, right, right. And yeah, I wouldn't know anything about getting caught in the web of endless
research.
Well,
you click on an article and then they say for more on this. Read, and you might click on that, and it's interesting.
No, I waste years doing that.
Oh, you do? Okay.
Other than write, No, it's terribly fun, and setting these around different locations around the world that gives you an opportunity to travel there. When you go to a place, tell me about living kind of in the world as a writer. What you pay attention to? If you're walking around taking notes, kind of what you're listening for, what you're looking for when you travel to a new place to write a novel.
Well, I think you're always looking at the people and overhearing dialogue and just getting the feeling of a town. I mean, right now I am writing a book or finishing it up that Reagan goes back for her 10th college reunion, and I'm setting it in the Berkshires. I went to college in Western Massachusetts, and a lot of what I'm putting in the book is based on my experience going to Mount Holyoke.
Oh, yeah.
And so I have a lot of my pictures from college, and I, of course, went back up there, and I was just at a reunion a couple of years ago and took notes. So you're really just looking for the flavor and the feeling and what's going on. Well, what is it like? I mean, are you in Western Massachusetts? Or I said a different book in Las Vegas, which, of course, is totally different. So you just have a different feeling for each place and try to pick up on what kind of mystery would work there.
Are there characters in here that have given you more trouble, you know, ancillary characters that you've had a hard time kind of accessing, and how do you get into them?
Well, you write and rewrite, or you might even get rid of a character. I had a character in this book that just wasn't working, so I said I don't really need her. For the ancillary characters, I think it's drawing on people you've known in life a little bit, or maybe personalities that are out there that you know of, that you know that you've come across all different types of people in your life, I'm sure.
Yeah.
And so if you can draw a little bit from them and then use your imagination.
Right.
You can draw these people.
My, I don't want to confess that I've been stalking you, but I've watched a number of interviews you've done.
Oh, you have? Okay.
Oh, yes. I became a Carol Higgins Clark interview junkie or something over the past several days.
Oh, well, thank you. Thank you.
But you have so many wonderful stories of real life that it's clear that a lot of your material is generated from just strange things that have happened to you in the world. And then I started thinking, I wonder if this, you know, strange things happen to everybody and we're just not paying close enough attention, or, you know, if Carol is blessed with all of these, you know, kind of weird coincidences that have happened to her.
Let me think. My second book, my first book was The Murder on the Cruise Ship, and in a reunion in Oxford, England, I'd gone to a school there, not to Oxford, and I made that up. But my second book, we called that one Decked. And then my second book was about a murder at a pantyhose convention, and I said if that was Decked, there should be Snagged. And that's why I have my one-word titles. But that, I had dated a man who had a pantyhose business, and I went with him to a convention. So I said, well, if I'm writing humorous mysteries, I've got to use a pantyhose convention in it.
Absolutely.
So that's how I ended up with that. So I do try and use things in life or things that happen along the way. And for every writer, whatever happens in their life is grist for the mill,
yeah.
I think.
Yeah.
There's nothing that goes unnoticed, or you think, I've got to use that in a book. Or even that's what friends say to me a lot. Oh, you should use that in a book, or don't use that in a book, you know, if they did something. But I think, you know, every waking moment almost is possible.
It's fodder, right?
Material.
Yeah, right. Yeah, I was going to ask you that. If your friends, you know, living with a writer, if they find themselves censoring everything they say around you, or if, you know, you're pulling out notebooks at
lunch.
Oh,
no, good friends don't. I mean, they know. They might joke about it. But, no, I was on a, someone cooked me dinner once, a date, and his ex-girlfriend came banging at the door. He turned to me and goes, you're not going to put this in the book, are you? No. I mean, it was just.
But I will say it on the radio.
But I will say it on radio, right? I didn't say it was a long time ago. But I would never model a character so closely after someone I know where it was obvious and, it, you know, someone who is an eccentric character or, you know, one of the villains or something like that. I never come that close. I just, try and, again, use what I see in life and experience.
Right. You are listening to Writers on Writing. My guest this morning is Carol Higgins Clark, author of the wonderful Reagan Riley mystery series. We're coming up on, there's one coming out in 2017, yeah? Or is there one coming
16.
Out? 16.
2016, yes.
Perfect. And do we have the title for that one yet?
Oh, it's called Knocked.
Oh, perfect.
Yeah, and this is the one I'm finishing up right now.
Do you think that writing begets more writing as you're writing? Does it generate more ideas, or after so many, do you start to say, you know, God, I've run out of material here?
Well, whenever you start a new book, or whenever I do, I always think, well, wait a minute, did I do that? I don't want to repeat myself. But there are always different stories and different twists, and you make up different characters. So I think if you have people who want to read your books, you can't have, what they say, there are only 7 plots in the world anyway, but
right.
It's just about having an enjoyable read for the reader and telling a new story that, I guess they say you could give the same plot to a lot of different, 10 different writers and you'd get 10 different stories anyway.
Right.
I was asked to write a short story once, it was for a charity, and it was called The Plot Thickens. And each writer had to use a thick book, a thick steak, and a thick fog in the story. That's all you were given. So naturally, there were 10 or however many were in the collection, very different stories.
I
used my acting background. You know, I had a commercial actress who lives in West Hollywood who gets cast in a commercial for a steak sauce. So, you know, that's where you got the thick steak. And they had a fog machine on set. You know, something happened. So, again, it was using my background as an actor in that. And other writers come to writing after doing other kinds of work, and they incorporate that into their stories as well.
You bring up a good point about acting and writing, and, you know, certainly some of it can generate some material. But I was wondering, if you approach writing, do you think differently than, say, your mother, who isn't an actress, with a different understanding of character or sort of a more visual, you know, actor sort of? I'm just wondering if that medium has fed your writing in a different way, do you think?
Yeah, that's a very good question. I'm having dinner with my mother tonight. I'll have to talk to her about that. But when I approach it, my acting background or my training, they teach you so much about before a scene, what is the life of the character, what's going on, what's the physical state, what's the emotional state. When you go and watch a play and an actor comes on stage, the character's life doesn't begin just then. Like, what happened before it? In that character's life, not the actor's. And it's like when you start writing a book, who are these people? You've got to figure it out. What has their life been like, and why are they acting the way they are or doing the things that they are?
Yeah.
So my acting background has helped with that because I had so much training in that. But, well, actually, my mother wanted to be an actress, and she did acting in high school, the high school plays, that kind of thing.
Oh, really?
But, yeah, and... But they didn't have much money. Her father had died, so she went to secretarial school after college. You know, she wanted to go to the American Academy of Dramatic Arts, and she went to secretarial school and started working in advertising. And then after she married my father, she took a writing class. So it worked out for her, but she has acting in her blood. You know, she likes the whole field, so
that is funny.
Maybe we don't think that differently when we start.
Right, right. Bringing that up, I had heard in many of your interviews the early passing of your father. You had a lot of encounters with death at an early time, and you're such a humorous writer, but yet a mystery writer. And I was wondering if all of that sort of, you know, childhood experience with early death and grief combined with your wonderful humor, if there's something in there that you feel like you draw from, if humor is an antidote to grief or...
I think it is. Sorry,
you
finished the question.
Yeah, go ahead.
I think it is, but my father, I mean, I was only 8 when he died, so I couldn't appreciate a sense of humor the way an adult would, you know. But apparently he was very funny, and people in my family are funny anyway, but I think you probably do like to laugh more when you've been through a lot of grief or... your attitude about things change, you know, what becomes important. And sometimes the things that make us laugh are the ones that can seem so important, and they're so stupid to have put such a high importance on certain things. And so I think that experience, of course, affected me, but there was humor in my family to start with.
Yeah, yeah. There's a funny story from one of your interviews about showing up at a cemetery plot to visit some relatives, and somebody snuck into your family grave.
Well, that was my grandmother had bought a plot at Gate of Heaven Cemetery in Westchester, New York, and she had bought it in the 30s, I guess, and it was for 72 people. So, I mean, I don't know why she bought it for so many people. Well, luckily there weren't many people on it for long, and then my father and grandmother died the same night, and then my uncle died 4 months later. So we had about 7 people in the plot, and my mother wanted to go visit there a few years ago because, you know, we're not there as much. He died over 50 years ago. And we went and visited, and my mother said, let's go down to the office. You know, they didn't tend the trees around the grave properly or the bushes. So we went down and checked in. We said, yes, blah, 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 Clark. And the woman at the computer, she said, so you have 8 people in the grave? And I said, no, we don't. We have 7. And my mother said, well, wait a minute. And she starts counting on her fingers. There's Daddy, Mimi. And I said, Mom, we were just there. There are 7 names on it. So the woman went back and got one of those old books, you know, what do you call them? I can't think of the name. You know, those
big ledger or something.
The ledgers, exactly, ledgers. And she opened it up, and you saw the old handwriting from like when my grandfather died in 1940 something. And she said, "Raymond." No, she said, "Vinny." I said, "Who was the last name in there?" And she said, "Vincent so and so." We said, "He's not ours." White out and whited out his name in the ledger. That's what happened. So we don't know whether he ended up in the grave or not, or he's in the next grave. So now we call him Cousin Vinny.
But we know that his name is whited out.
His name was whited out. I mean, just the way she very clinically got the white out, shook the bottle, and whited out Vinny's name. So
that is hilarious.
Yeah, and that's it. That's it. I guess. Yeah, you saw that one. So that was just. Unbelievable when that happened.
I love it. My guest this morning is Carol Higgins Clark, and she is going to be at the Orange County Sisters in Crime. It's a nonprofit organization that puts on fantastic events. The Ladies of Intrigue is coming up October 3rd at the Hotel Huntington Beach. You can find out information about it at ocsistersincrime.org, a fantastic nonprofit org where you can... I think there's like, I don't know how many of there's two keynotes, and there's a bunch of really wonderful mystery writers that are doing panel discussions. Barbara is a moderator there. So be sure and check that out if you are a mystery fan. This is a day you absolutely don't want to miss. Let's finish up with some of the nuts and bolts of writing for our writing audience here. You had said that it's most effective for you to have sort of two different plot lines and stories that kind of go back and forth and feed on each other. Is that sort of a good rule of thumb for mystery writing in general, or, you know, kind of, I don't know?
Well, it's kind of what works for me. I had started out by retyping my mother's books for her before there were computers. So when I started writing, that was very helpful to me. And I think sometimes she has a few different things going on. That's what just seemed to work for me, because also I don't have any, I had had someone murdered in my first book 10 years before, but I often need something else going on, because I don't usually use murders or a big crime that could fill a whole book. And in this one, I have Reagan going back to her college reunion. She stops at a diner where she knew the people, and something happened to them. They had just been robbed. And then there's another crime that's about to happen. So I'm doing the same thing. It's so funny you talk about that. And, you know, trying to blend them together, and it all culminates reunion weekend when Reagan is there. I get it just works for me. I would say anybody who wants to write, look at the mystery writers you like and see what they do, because everybody does something different.
Yeah.
And then tell your own story the best way that you can. I wouldn't say it's a rule to have two different plot lines going on, but if that works for you and you can kind of tie them together at the end in some way, then do it.
Yeah.
But I would just read the mystery writers you like and study them, and see what would work for you.
Talk a little bit about maintaining suspense and when to distribute clues.
It's so funny. It's so much of it is writing and rewriting. Like right now I'm doing a lot of rewriting of these chapters just to make them stronger. And I think I'm putting an extra clue in here and there because of the way the book turned out, you know, the first draft. I think it's just rewriting, actually, getting it down, keeping the reader interested. I mean, something's got to happen, obviously. You know, you can't just amble along with a lot of descriptions of things. But you have to keep action going, of course. And in each chapter, you might want to sit down and say, what do I want to accomplish? It's got to move the story forward, of course. It has to keep the reader reading, and it has to be interesting.
Right.
So I don't think there's any great explanation of how to do it. I think some of it is hit and miss. You know, you just write and you rewrite.
I was going to say, some of this comes very naturally for some and so unnaturally for others that it's, you know, very difficult for some people to maintain and dole out suspense. I was at an event last night and something very interesting came up about the difference between shock and suspense. And maintain, you know, it's often confused, I think, by at least by new writers, that if I shock the reader, I'll try and substitute that in for, you know, maintaining intrigue and page turning. And they are two very different things. And I think that's worth noting for new writers, at least.
Absolutely. You don't have to have a room, you know, somebody walk in and, you know, you've been robbed because the place is torn apart. Sometimes it's much scarier to come home and then you notice something's off and wait a minute, was someone in here? You know, it's creepier than just calling the police right away. I think that scene in Misery, did you ever see Misery when Kathy Bates, you know, realizes that the writer had gotten out of the bed and tried to escape because one of her little trinkets had been moved? I mean, that was much scarier.
Terrifying, right? Terrifying.
Then if she had walked in and found the place all a mess, you know, it was more when you saw the expression on her face that she knew something was out of place.
Exactly.
And to me, that's a lot scarier.
Absolutely.
Really a lot scarier.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Are there pieces of advice we should have talked about that we didn't? What should we have talked about that we didn't?
Excuse me?
What should we have talked about that we didn't?
I think it's just encouraging people to do it, to come to an event like the one I'm going to be at on October 3rd. There's nothing like being around other writers, getting feedback, talking about how it works, because writing is isolating, of course. But if you want to write, come to an event like that, take a class, and then just sit down and do it, and don't edit yourself. Get it down, because your first time you write a chapter, that's not the end of it. You're going to rewrite, and it's always hardest. You can be hard on yourself, thinking, oh, this is no good. Just get it down, and I think that's an important thing for people who want to write, because it'll be better than you think, and then you can rewrite it. When I do a chapter, I print it out, and then I make changes, put them in the computer, I print it out, and I say, how did I miss that? I used the same word twice, just as an example, and I keep doing it and until I'm, you know, happy enough with it. And that's what writing is about. It's not, I think people get scared thinking if they put something down and they don't think it's any good. Well, that's just the beginning of it.
Right.
It's like rehearsing for a play. I mean, why do people rehearse and rehearse and rehearse? It's because it changes and it hopefully gets better.
Yeah, exactly. Do you and your mom read each other's work, or do you have other readers for your work?
Well, my editor, of course, and then we'll read each other's stuff along the way.
Okay.
And just, you know, say, give some feedback, which is helpful.
Yeah.
To just get it from someone who is not going to say, oh, everything's perfect if they don't think it is, you know?
Right.
You're just, sorry, I think you need something here or there. We like to do that for each other.
Do you wait until you're at a certain point with it before you, I mean, do you make it as absolutely good as you can make it before you show it to anybody? Or do you try and get a little bit of feedback and guidance along the way so you don't go too far astray?
I usually send stuff to my editor along the way. And then also I would give it to my mother as well, just to get the feeling for a story. But, I mean, I would never hand anything over before I thought it was at least good enough. I wouldn't just, you know, bang something out and hand it to them. I do some editing myself before I'd have anybody read it.
What a fantastic resource to have your mom as, you know.
Oh, definitely. Definitely,
a guardian
angel. It's great. It's great. And writing together was fun, too. And
I know. We didn't even get to talk about that. Gosh.
Yeah. It all started because I retyped her books for her on her old electric typewriter all those years ago.
Isn't that great? I love it.
Yeah.
I love it. Carol Diggins-Clark, what a pleasure. Thank you so much. And
thank you so much.
I will give one more plug. I want everybody to who is interested in mystery writing, even if you aren't. I mean, Carol raises a great point about hanging out in a community of writers. It's such an isolating profession, and so when you have the chance to be with other writers, to hear their process, to hear their struggles, why not take advantage of it? So she is going to be Saturday, October 3rd here at the Hotel Huntington Beach. And you can go on that website, nonprofit organization, ocsistersincrime.org. Carol, what a pleasure. We will anxiously await Reagan next year.
Well, thank you very much.
Wonderful. Thanks so much. That was Carol Higgins-Clark. Stay tuned. Daniel James Brown will be back with us for the second half hour. You're listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting live from the University of California campus in Irvine. We're streaming on the web at kuci.org. This show will join the other interviews up on the web and available to you via podcast. Feel free to visit iTunes. We're under College Radio. Or you can always visit Barbara's website, penonfire.com. We have downloads. We have information on upcoming shows. We have hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of past shows from the like 19 years or 17 years that we've been on the air. I am your co-host, Marie Stone. Onward with the show. Daniel James Brown is the author of the number one New York Times bestseller, The Boys in the Boat, which won an ABA Nonfiction Book of the Year Award and the Washington State Book Award. His two previous nonfiction books, The Indifferent Stars Above and Under a Flaming Sky, were both finalists for the Washington State Book Award. He has taught writing at San Jose State University and Stanford University. Yesterday, Viking, an imprint of Penguin Young Readers, released a young readers edition of The Boys in the Boat. First released in 2013, the novel has spent more than 150 weeks on the New York Times bestseller list. Foreign rights have been sold in more than 13 markets, and there are currently more than 1 million copies in print. Daniel was on the show last year with the release of the paperback, chatting with my co-host Nicole. I really encourage everyone listening, if they're interested in this book and hearing more about it, to look up a podcast of that interview. It's wonderful. It goes in-depth into the book, into Daniel's research process, maintaining suspense, all that sort of stuff that we're not going to duplicate today. So check out that podcast and our website. Daniel, welcome back.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Hi. So hardcover, paperback, movie rights, foreign rights, book for young adults. Are you tired of talking about it now?
No, I'm still enjoying talking about it. It's a, you know, it's one of those stories that I fell into, 7 years ago, and it just has intrigued me ever since. And I still enjoy getting out and talking to folks about it, talking on the radio, and keeping it alive.
It certainly has intrigued the U.S. and, well, I guess the world at large, too. But I've heard that it's gone on to be a like a team leadership book. And obviously now it's a young person's book. Like it's really cut across a number of varied and unique markets and become sort of a, as you've called it, a perfect metaphor for team building and for pulling yourself up by your bootstraps and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah, somewhat to my surprise, not long after the adult edition came out, I started getting requests from all kinds of teams, a lot of them actually corporate teams, including one in Irvine, people asking me to come and talk to their organizations about team building and how teams evolve organically, how they function optimally, and topics like that, which was somewhat of a surprise for me. I mean, I had written a book, an historical narrative about this this crew that went to Berlin, the Berlin Olympics, and I'm certainly not a management guru or anything like that. So it was a little bit of a surprise to me. But once I actually thought about it and went and started talking to different groups, in fact, I found that there are all kinds of synergies and ways that the story can inform really any kind of group endeavor. So it was kind of a revelation to me, but actually it turned out to be something that really did work.
Yeah, no, it's really spoken to a lot of people. It almost seems like in the past 2 years of talking about the book, I'm almost thinking that you could write some sort of, you know, beyond the boat story about the, you know, the aftermath of the book's release and what it's meant to people, particularly young people, as we're going to talk about today, but more of what you've learned about the story and living through not only the writing and research of it, but through the conversations and the readers' reflections and so on.
Yeah, you know, I mean, another surprise I got shortly after the original adult edition came out was I started getting emails from people saying they had just finished the book and they had tears in their eyes as they finished it. And that also was something of a revelation to me. I mean, one forgets when one is sitting alone in an office writing a book that there are real people out there and that the book has an impact, hopefully a positive impact on people's lives. And I was kind of staggered by the reaction. You know, this book, as you say, it wound up on the New York Times bestseller list. It's been there for over a year. It did that almost entirely through word of mouth. We never got a New York Times book review or, you know, big national media exposure like the Today Show or whatever. So the book has spread, as I say, almost entirely by word of mouth. And that really gratifies me as a writer because what I know that it's I know it's not just, you know, a commercial product. It is, of course, a commercial product, but it's much more than that. It's something that's touching people's lives, and people are feeling compelled to talk to other people about it. And so just as a writer, you know, I find that very gratifying.
I like to do those Nielsen surveys when you're on a when you're on an airplane and you can, you know, like JetBlue and everybody's television set is on and you can see what people what's trending in the, you know, random market of an airplane. And
yeah.
I was on a flight recently from New York to back to California, and I saw three of your books being read. and then I got home. We have one of those little libraries in our front lawn, and and it was in there. And I thought, okay, there's a sign. The universe is telling me to pick up this book. So I think you're right. It certainly has gained momentum, but. I guess, you know, and what we're talking about with the book serving so many different markets for so many different reasons, you know, it all makes sense that old people and young people alike are embracing this. So congratulations
yeah. Well, that's another thing that happened over the, you know, as the book came out and gained popularity. Another thing that happened was I started getting emails from people saying, I love this story. It's got so many life lessons in it. It speaks so much to the lives of young Americans and what they were like in the 1930s. I wish there was a copy my granddaughter or my son or my student could read. And that's really how we just came to decide to do a young readers edition, was just that there were a lot of people out there asking for a version of the book that kids, 10 to 13, something like that, could read on their own.
Yeah, so let's talk about that and how the adaptation differs from the original. If there was more research that you had, I mean, I assume that I know that a lot of the intricate history and some of the overwhelming amount of information about the Germans and the Nazis got a little bit condensed and pulled out. Was there additional research that you had to do to put into the book, or tell me a little bit about the process of adapting it?
No, so what we did is, as you say, we cut out a lot of the more esoteric stuff about, social conditions in Nazi Germany and some of the technical stuff about rowing, the ideal rowing stroke and things like that, the economic background for the Great Depression. We left all that history in there, but we cut it back and we removed the more esoteric discussions. But mostly is, and that shortened the book a good deal. It's probably half the length of the adult edition, or a little more than that, maybe 60%. But a lot of what we did actually, along with shortening chapters and things like that, breaking it into more chapters so you had shorter chunks, a lot of what we did was actually add stuff. We added photos, particularly of these people when they were kids. We added a photo gallery of all the characters in the book to make it easier to keep track of who was who and to identify with them as people. We added a timeline to help kids keep track of what was happening. Because the story has several strands. There's a strand set here in Seattle. There's a strand in Germany, and so on and so forth. So a timeline to help them keep that straight. and a diagram of a rowing shell to rather than a discussion about how shells work and things like that. So we added visual elements that we think will help kids get their minds around some of that material without lengthy discussions of them.
It's killing me because I was not a fantastic history student, and I was thinking if some of these books had been made available. I mean, you have books like The Diary of Anne Frank or something where you have accessible human stories to put on history. But I thought, what a wonderful way to teach that period of history in a very engaging, exciting way that young people can relate to, because the young people were part of that book and part of that history. It seems like it's really going to make an otherwise, for perhaps some students, a dry subject much more accessible. I think you should devote your life to doing this for every piece of history.
Well, we shall see, but I certainly hope that's the case. I mean, that history is so interesting, but it's interesting to me, and I think to most people, because of the people who live through it. And these nine young men from Western Washington who lived through the Depression and pulled off this amazing feat in the middle of the Depression and rowed against a German boat in front of Hitler in Berlin, they were kids that I think almost any American, and you don't have to be American, I think, anybody can really identify with them, because they were ordinary working class kids. And so I think that, for young people, because they were young themselves, these boys, I think that I think it'll help. I think it'll help bring that passage of history, really those several different pieces of history, the Great Depression in America, the rise of the Nazis in Germany, the Dust Bowl. I think it'll help enliven any discussions that that they might have in their history class or wherever, because they will be able to attach those historical developments to the lives of real people and what happened to them. So that's certainly the hope, and I think that will happen.
Yeah, I do too. I do too. Do you think if this book had been released in the 70s or the 80s, it would have been met with a different reception, meaning... Do you think there is something unique about the time period we're living through now that's in conversation with the Depression and the Dust Bowl?
I do think so. I think the time was ripe for this book. I mean, we're certainly not in the middle of the Great Depression, but we have just been through a long economic downturn. Times have been hard. A lot of families have suffered a great deal. And I think more than that, there just seems to be a kind of uncertainty and dissatisfaction in the air these days with the way things are going. And that was, of course, very much the story in America in the 1930s. People were so uncertain of what was going to come next, and they were so confused about the forces at work in the world, and so much of it was dark and threatening. So I think you're right. I think in the 70s or the 80s, the book might not have had as much resonance as it does in our current time. So they're a little bit more uncertain, I think.
Yeah, yeah. I know that you're a voluminous, very thorough researcher, and I was wondering about the darlings that got cut from either the adult book or the adaptation, but probably even more the adult book, pieces of history that you found fascinating that just couldn't fit into the scope of the story that didn't make it in.
Yeah, I mean, I got kind of upset. I'm kind of an obsessive researcher, and sometimes it's helpful and sometimes it works against me, because I wind up sometimes spending weeks researching something and writing about it in much more detail than is warranted. So I, for instance, when I was writing the adult edition of the book, I became absolutely obsessed with what was going on in Nazi Germany in the middle 30s and how the Nazis were using the Olympic Games as a propaganda device, and particularly the role that Joseph Goebbels played in his Ministry of Propaganda. And so I read many, many books about that, did enormous amount of research about it, and wrote probably 40 pages more about it than anybody would sensibly put in a book. So fortunately, I realized that myself, and I cut way back on it. My editor cut back on it some more, and we got it down to an amount of material that I think actually helps the story rather than gets in its way. But, you know, you do. I mean, that's what motivates me as a writer, is I get so interested in so many of these things. I get passionate about it. And I'd rather do that and waste a little time writing too much and then go back and prune and cut and shape later than have an ill-informed book, one that I don't really feel confident in what I'm talking about.
I read that you went so far as to be examining microfiche photos of kids sitting on college campuses and the way they're holding their backs and how many of them are smoking, and zooming in on the headlines of what papers they're reading that day and what's playing in the movie theaters. And it seems like, for me, I know, I could get lost in that and actually never write the book. So I wonder when you were able to tell yourself, you know, it's time to stop. I need to.
Okay, yeah, so that pertains, like, to the first scene in the book, describes Joe Rance and Roger Morris, two of these boys. The first day, they turned out for crew practice, and they walked across the campus and down the shell house and turned out for the crew program. And so I only do that kind of very granular research when I know roughly what a scene is going to be, and I knew that first scene in the book was going to describe these two guys meeting and going down to the shell house. And so what I did was I decided, well, I need to know. I knew what day that was. I knew a little bit from talking to Joe and Roger about the route they traveled down there and what happened when they got to the shell house. But I wanted to really bring the scene to life. So I went and I found pictures taken on the University of Washington campus that week, and it showed clusters of students sitting around in circles. Both the boys and the girls, the men and the women, were smoking cigarettes. They were reading newspapers. So I went and I got newspapers for that day, and I saw what was in the headlines. I saw that the World Series had ended the night before, and so on and so forth. So once I know what a scene is going to be, I do a very, very granular, particular, detailed kind of research to try to bring that scene to life, because I really do find that it's those little details, like what kinds of clothes kids were wearing on the campus that day and what the weather was like that day and what they were reading and thinking about that day. Those kinds of details are what are going to make the story come to life in the end.
Yeah, the most remarkable thing about that is that it wasn't raining. I'm from Seattle, so
yeah, so you know.
Really? They're sitting out on the lawn?
It was a beautiful day. So.
So let's talk a little bit for our writing audience about your organizational method for all of the research and how you integrate it, kind of what your office space looks like when you're embroiled in a project like this and you know, how you structure all of this and put it together. Do you use big, billboards? Cork boards? Or is everything in the computer? Talk kind of a little bit about your structural process.
I'm sitting here looking at my desk and very happy you can't see it, because it is a pile of notes and coffee cups and books and all kinds of stuff. I'm a pretty messy writer, to tell you the truth, in terms of procedure and process. It's pretty chaotic for me. But I will tell you, you know, some of the things that I think helped me cut through the chaos. In this particular book, I really wanted to understand the large arc of the story before I got down into the weeds and starting writing those particular scenes that I was just talking about. So I spent probably the first year that I was researching the book doing nothing except constructing a timeline. Everything that I thought was relevant that happened here in Seattle with these nine boys, that was happening in America, larger American society, that was happening over in Germany between 1933 and 1936, finding events that I thought were potential scenes. So I spent a year basically just one long Word document with a series of dates and things that happened on this date, things that happened the next day, things that happened 2 days later. It was kind of exhausting, but it allowed me at the end of that process to stand back and see the big sweep of the story, where it began, where it was going, and where it would end up. And that was very helpful. And then once I had done that, of course, I threw out a great many of those pieces of information and concentrated on the ones that I thought were really key to the story, which was a story of, you know, these ordinary kids encountering these challenges, rising to the challenges, and ultimately prevailing. And I picked out the things that were really key in that. And then I went back, and I just started writing scenes, starting with that first scene I just described very briefly to you. And my process has always been to take that first scene, think about it to death, research it to death, just live in that scene for a few days until I get to the point where I know everything I need to know and everything I want to know about what's going to go in that scene. Then I sit down and because I have thought about it so much in so much detail and done such granular research, usually the actual writing of the scene just comes very fast to me. I just sit down and I write it. So in an hour or two at my computer, I write that first scene. What I do then is I print that scene out, I put it in a drawer, I move on and start the next scene, and then the next scene after that. And as I start marching through the book writing scenes, periodically I stop and I go back and I look at those earlier scenes. I pull them out of the drawer because I made a point of not looking at them for a couple weeks at this point. And when I go back and I look at them, I always see stuff I had never seen before. I see faults and perhaps strengths that I hadn't been aware of when I wrote them. So I always make a revision of the scene, and then I put it back in the drawer and just keep going. So I get in this iterative sort of process of writing new scenes, going back and looking at old scenes, revising the older scenes, moving forward, writing some new scenes. And eventually, I wind up with a complete manuscript when I stick all those scenes together.
That's helpful. That's really helpful. That's the most thorough explanation of that I've heard in a long time. That's wonderful. We're drawing down on our time, but I was just listening to a very interesting TED Talk with Elizabeth Gilbert on creativity and writing in the aftermath of success, and she was saying after she wrote Eat, Pray, Love, people were continuously coming up to her saying, you know, now what are you going to do? How are you going to top that?
Yeah.
And I wondered if you had any thoughts about that.
That sounds very, very familiar. It is kind of a dilemma, you know. I mean, it's a happy dilemma, obviously. Any writer wants his or her book to have great success. But I'm sort of living with that right now. There are a lot of people who would like me to be working on another book right now, and I think I'd like to be writing again soon. But it is hard to find, particularly when you write this sort of narrative nonfiction that I do, I can't just make a story up. I have to go find a good story out there. And it really has to have all the elements of a good story. So people come to me all the time with stories about their father or their aunt or themselves or whatever that are good stories, but they aren't necessarily great stories. They don't necessarily have all the elements that I want. This story had all those elements. It set a pretty high bar. And so right now I'm being pretty picky. I'm trying to hold back and wait for a story that that really, I think, rises to the same level in terms of just general universal interest that this story has. And whether that takes a year or several years, I'm not sure. I'm not sure. I suppose I'll ever find it. But I think I will if I am patient and bide my time and really, really look hard at each idea that comes along. So that's what it is an interesting dilemma. And it's kind of stressful at times because there's a lot of pressure to write another book. But I don't want to just write a book just to write a book. I want to write a book because I'm passionate about it.
Right, right. And you had, with the Donner Party, you had a story that people knew, but you found a new angle into it. And I guess that would be another example of how to come at it is, even if the story has already been told, you find a different way to tell it, I guess.
Yeah, I had happened to have a family connection with the Donner Party that gave me a sort of an angle into finding an angle, basically. And yeah, that's absolutely, you know, it can be a story that's been told many times. If you have a unique angle on it, you can do good stuff with it.
Yeah. Daniel James Brown, this was a huge pleasure. Thank you so much for coming back on.
Great. Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you. Congratulations. That was Daniel James Brown. The book is now out in adapted for young readers, still called Boys in the Boat. So you can find that if you have a child between the ages of sort of 10, 13, a really fantastic read. That is all the time we have for today. We will be back here with you next Wednesday morning at 9 a.m. Sister Rue is coming up with a little bit of reggae for your Wednesday morning, so stay tuned for that. Thanks so much for joining me. Have a great day.